I think it would be incredibly relevant and useful if someone would do the research, if it could be done, to find out just what does England own that is America. It would all be behind, you know, virtual corporations in the Bahamas and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But seeing what David Icke managed to collect as information in his books, he names names and dates and who owns what and who
BP
did what.
Probably owns half of the oil.
What's that?
BP.
British
BP.
Petroleum.
Yeah.
British Petroleum.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
British Petroleum.
Yeah.
What are they doing in offshore waters of America? Why is it their equipment? Why isn't it at Mobil Exxon? You know, why isn't it Shell? which I think is Dutch. Shell is Dutch. Mobil Exxon, I don't know what that is. I don't know if it's American or what. But it's an intriguing thought that this idea that the Travis Stock Committee evolved into a kind of American aristocratic promotional campaign to promote the idea that there is class in America, and that if you're part of the upper class, you have entitlement. If you're part of the lower class, then you are in a servile position. And in America, which you can bet that at the time that the British lost the Revolutionary War, they were eating their fingernails out of their goddamn fingers to think how much they had lost in terms of wealth, because they have always been interested in that. They had India. They had China. They owned it.
Yeah, that's probably how the English got, you know, 1/6. It's what's left over from the English Empire. And that was, it was naval war. Because they were on the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, they were able to get everywhere really fast, really easy. They fought the Dutch for a while. But, and then I guess in World War II they lost it. And the Nazis, but fighting the Nazis cost them a lot of money, and they've lost a lot, but they've still retained a lot, and they own a lot here.
Well, there was a picture in Yahoo, when you go into Yahoo and they have the news page, there was a picture yesterday of downtown London at night, light sparkling, and it said England surpasses America as the most, as the, I don't know what they called it, the financial, you know,
center
of the West, second only to China. So America has lost its status as the leading.
Wow, New York's down.
Deal. And who's got it? London. And who is at the core of London? The royal family.
Interesting.
So that we really, you know, when people talk about how the Constitution was built in such a way as to. One of the things that Jefferson is famous for is that he anticipated the need for another revolution. That democracy is something that is a continuous revolutionary. It's unfinished.
We don't have the equality we were talking about earlier.
Yes.
And so the land or the vote.
So
or
this link between the metaphysical and the political is really a very relevant thing when you consider how we are now capable of being manipulated by the depth of scientific knowledge about cognitive, what do they call these? There's a new offshoot of linguistics called cognitive science, I think is what it's referred to. And it studies how repeated instructions or descriptions create a synaptical pathway in the brain. And this synaptical pathway, once it gets established, it doesn't have to be established as, you know, front page headlines. It just has to be on page 14 and page 23 and page 26 for about 4 or 5 years. And this phrase, in this article about the Travis Stock Committee at that website, educateyourself.org, talks about how it uses some examples that are very convincing of how, for instance, the Iraq War was sold by creating little snippet two-word phrases that justify the intent in a new framework that makes it acceptable to be sending the entire army of the United States to 15,000 miles away on the other side of the planet as being self-defense. It's like it was sold. We were cognitively trained to accept the idea that this was a perfectly reasonable thing.
Terrorists, that's one key word.
Terrorists, that's right.
Control, mm-hmm. Terrorist right. control.
Yeah.
I can't think of what else, but I mean...
I know, I can't hang on to those phrases either. They have some really good examples, very subtle ones, on this article about the Tavistock Committee.
Well, you know, your brain processes words the same in everybody. They can actually put electrodes on your head and tell what you're thinking by because the brain patterns are the same for everyone for words. So words are very powerful in the brain. And they're also, in metaphysics, they're extremely powerful, the names of God and everything.
Images and synaptical pathways.
Mm-hmm.
To link the linkage here, I think, between the political and the metaphysical is the word imagination. I think that if you think of the fundamentals of Orthodox religions, the fundamental thing that they're doing in setting up a hierarchical priest group at the top.
Hierophant.
The Hierophant. Yeah.
It's almost hierarchical. It probably comes from
the chief pope, the chief priest. The chief priests are there to convince you that you don't need to create. You just need to follow the wisdom with respect of these elder men who will make your decisions for you because they are so wise and so good and so deep and insightful. You do not have to create, which means you do not have to use your imagination. All you have to do in order to be acceptable to your fellow people is use the buzzwords that the priests give you. Mm-hmm. And then you're being humble, and you're accepting a slap on the face for brotherhood, and you're accepting the powers that be as being God-granted. Mm-hmm. And for most of that time that orthodoxies were the ruling religions, there was aristocracies who they served. They promoted the idea that the aristocracies were themselves promoting, which is that the king is king by the choice of God. It's a divine
right. Yeah.
It's a divine right, the divine right of kings. So the divinity of kings and queens is something that was part of that same philosophical outlook. You don't need to think. This is too complex for you.
Mm-hmm.
You're not here. you're not here to come up with original thoughts. In fact, it's a sin to go outside the scripture. So that now you've got in America 70 million people. Who really do believe that they're going to die and they're going to be reborn in heaven with pretty bodies. They're going to have bodies in heaven, and they're going to be rich, and they're going to have two cars, and they're going to have big screen TVs, and they're going to have air conditioning. You know, they really believe this. This is insanity. This is a form of actual living zombies they have guns. They have money. They have police forces. And they're here among us. Mm-hmm. On that note, I've got a song to address that.
Okay.
Hey.
Stonehenge moors, abductions by UFO. They showed the autopsy on TV. The alien had six little toes. Global warming and the end of time. Voodoo economics. Hurricanes and tornado packs. Shift and plate tectonics. The billionaires want new DNA. The rapture's at the end of May. It's just another day. It's just another day. radio. This war for oil is overrated. Took it to the Senate to get the truth. Found out they're incorporated. The grandchildren will have to pay. The Congress said that's okay. It's just another day. Woo! Got a coaching for. He's sweating hell bent for leather. His wheels on fire. It's raining drops of blood. There's lightning in the weather. Hear the crack of the whip. He's docking to the mothership. This should be a trip. The clouds have all gone away. Can Sally come out to play? It's just another day. It's just another day.
Right.
Thank you.
Sounds so easy how you do that.
We're in a revolution. We are still fighting a revolution for democracy. And democracy for, I'd like to talk about democracy in the New Age. There's something that's, I think, suspicious about the New Age in that I've seen the whole thing evolve since the early 70s. All these ideas, all this goodwill, all these people, you know, you see these flyers in a health food store where there's this pretty blonde who's about 26, and she's a master of Reiki, you know, a master at 26, or someone who's going to teach you life enhancement. They're a master of life enhancement, you know. They're only 29 years old, smiling, pretty. And they got rent, and they got a car, and they got insurance, and they got to make some money. And they, this sounds like a good riff, you know. And I've been to some things where there was one guy who was teaching American Indian medicine mysticism, and he talked about all this stuff for about an hour. That was, I thought it was just some sort of like side trip that he was talking about that was eventually going to lead to the gist of it. And he said, well, after an hour gone by, he said, so, there we go. That's what I had to tell you. And I thought, you're not keeping my money. And I went up to him. I was polite enough to wait till there was a pause. And I said, I want my money back, man. He said, fine. Come into the other room. And he said, here's your money. Thank you for coming. It's perfectly all right if you don't understand what I'm saying, right? He's a total shyster, you know?
Yeah.
But the thing is that here we have this New Age deal. Where there's all these forms of mysticism, wish fulfillment, visualization, healing techniques and stuff, but they don't address democracy and egalitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
That's just mundane stuff. You don't do that with your spiritual, you know, illumination and your high, your spirit being. This stuff doesn't matter. It'll take care of itself if you think good thoughts. Bullshit. It won't take care of itself. And that's just what... I'm starting to call it the House of Lords is depending on. They want people to be New Age bubbleheads, and it just may be possible. I mean, this is a really cynical thought, but it's, you know, if these people could be part of something like the demolition of the Twin Towers and the murder of thousands of people. Wouldn't they be capable, for instance, in the late 70s, of promoting Gandhian nonviolence? Insert that in the papers. Insert that on the TV. Run bios on Gandhi, right?
Mm-hmm.
And talk about how nonviolence is the only way to address a difference of opinion with somebody else. Gandhi himself says in his autobiography, and I want to read it over again so I can get the quote just exactly like he said it. He says, if you're going to do nonviolence, you and you're prepared to give your life for it, the magic of it will work. It's a moral force field. The moral force field of nonviolence will work if you're willing to take it to the point, as he did, of walking into a club and getting clubbed on the head when he mm-hmm. knew he was going to get clubbed on the head. That's moral force, is saying, I'm putting spiritual power above material fear or material limitation. He said, if you're not willing to do that, you should fight a revolution.
Aha. Uh-huh.
He said, you should fight. And the nature of the earth, the nature of being physical and of being being cosmic in a place where there are forces interested in limiting your power and in making money off of your daily needs, selling you water, you know, selling you food at a profit, having... I was looking, my sister's interested in buying a house. She's studying to be a doctor in Mexico. She said, look around, see what there is. I could not find one small house in Capitola or the general area for under $600,000.
Yeah, you know, it's ridiculous.
And that means that the payments are $2,500 a month. So that if you're going to pay that kind of money and you're going to be committed for 30 years or until you can get rid of the thing, you're committed to possibly lose everything. You got to come up with, you know, $2,300 a month. Mm-hmm. Doing what?
Oh, it's like $6,000 a year in taxes, you know.
And then there's that.
There's $500 a month just in taxes.
Then there's the cars, and then there's mm-hmm. the kids, and the clothes, and the food. I mean, just to own a house, just to live in a house and have a respectable healthiness, and to not dress in rags, you have to practically join the mafia. You know, and this is an issue because we've got all these people in this country who they're not bad people, just like the Nazis weren't bad people, or not. I don't mean the Nazis, the Germans at the time of the Nazis uh-huh. who were misled by their propaganda.
Right.
You know, they weren't evil people. They were professors and teachers and doctors and bakers and the whole deal.
It's like the Antichrist. It subverts people, you know, with promises of wealth. And as long as you exploit other people, that's how you can get it. Because you can't really get it through your own labor unless you're, you know, a rock star or a, you know, sports hero or something.
It has to be exploitation. It's true. Right. You can't make a profit but through exploitation. And there's people who have been trained and taught that exploitation is really just capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a cognitive sort of glass ceiling to their thinking processes. They don't want to think about how, you know, you can promote Nike sneakers. It's just a shoe, you know. You don't want to think about the child labor in the mm-hmm. U.S. protectorate, where there's an army base
mm-hmm.
and radar, and they're screening Google, you know. And this is the dichotomy that we as Americans, as participants in a democracy, these are the things we're facing. And the payoff for being part of promoting a true egalitarian democracy is that your cosmic identity as a soul can shine through the window of your identity clearly, and you can be a cosmic person in a physical body. And that's, in essence, I think, what we're here to do. We're here to be our cosmic selves in our physical state.
Mm-hmm.
That is the mastery of the physical. That's what it means to be a Westerner, is to go through the body and touch the ground in with an alive mind and an alive heart. And then you have, as I think it, when you die and you leave your body, you're going to go into an astral construct that is the balanced cosmic state that you have achieved in your lifetime. You're going to shift from the boundaries of your physical body to the boundaries of your etheric construct. And it's like a spacecraft. You're going to enter a spacecraft. And if you do not have a spacecraft when you die, then you are going to float by magnetic attraction to the various hells that the Tibetans describe,
mm-hmm.
Where, you know, if you're full of lust. I've heard the wall of lust described. A couple of people have described it, this wall of naked bodies fucking each other. and they're just constantly, constantly addicted to sex. And they're just crawling over each other, wanting sex, 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 sex. If you don't get past that in this life, then you're going to dive into that until you are so exhausted that you are going to be assigned a life or another identity in another plane, another place. Same thing with drinking, same thing with drugs, mm-hmm. same thing with greed and gambling.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with all of them. So that what we are here to do is to establish a kind of an equilibrium in an astral state so that we have stability when we die, and then we can progress in a more elegant manner into love. Then we're capable of being responsible lovers. That's what we're here to learn how to do. And that's what egalitarianism and democracy, to me, is all about. Mm-hmm. It's about becoming a responsible for love, to love, so that you can have love. That's all we want. That's all I want. I want to feel love. And not necessarily human love, but just to be in that love magic, that love state, and progress from there. And that is the meaning of the American Revolution and of having created the first major democracy. And the forces that had been withholding people in the orthodox priestcraft monarchies all over the world, that's what they were preventing, and that's what our hurdle is. We've got to jump that hurdle.
We've gone part of the way with our democracy.
We've gone part of the way.
We still, because it's a republic, it still has some of that fascism grafted into it to protect. Because of the original founding fathers, the majority, other than Tom Paine, were wealthy landowners and tobacco farmers from England.
Yeah, and they wanted democracy, which gave them
exactly
democratic rights. But they liked having cheap labor,
slaves, and yeah.
Well, that's one thing that you got to give it to Lincoln in the North, man. That was a huge deal that they fought this Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
It was huge.
It was the unfinished part of it, because there was
It was an unfinished part.
The American Revolution, they had to leave slavery in because the South still had plenty, were dependent on it economically in the farming, whereas the North was more industrial, didn't quite need it as much. And we were talking about Paine earlier, and he was a co-founder of the first anti-slavery movement in the United
States.
Yeah.
Huh. You mentioned another writing of his,
Agrarian Justice. We were talking earlier about equality, the part I didn't actually get on the cool edit. You really have to listen to the show to catch everything. It was about that you have a birthright. God did not, create a title office and issue deeds. Everyone, in a free society, everyone is entitled to the land. It shouldn't be separated by wealth or... So he felt that your birthright, you should be compensated. If you don't own land, you should be getting some money from the people that do. My personal belief is that we should just redivide it all the time. And if you do have more than your fair share, depending on the population in the area, you should have to pay some extra tax on that. And then that would tend to equalize the financial money that people have, too. I mean, if that's where we spend all our money, is like you're saying, $600,000 for a house or something in here in Santa Cruz, it's ridiculous.
Where I lived in Taos, there was a very unique thing going on. I bought a quarter acre of land for $550.
But it's in the middle of nowhere, right?
It's in the middle of nowhere, but yeah. I parked my bus on it, and I had a place to live that was mine.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something that happened out there. At the time of the Seattle World's Fair, some promoter went out there, and they bought a number of sections of land. A section's a square mile. And they subdivided it into quarter-acre slots with... they drove a bulldozer in a straight line and made roads. And they had all the parcels surveyed, mm-hmm. and marked and mm-hmm. registered as separate pieces of property. And then they gave them away as prizes at the Seattle World's Fair in 63, I think it was. So people, won this thing, and they say, oh, well, we've got a piece of land in New Mexico, right? And then at that time, in the 50s, somebody told me, Land was going for $5 an acre in New Mexico.
Wow.
That land, that sage land, which, you know, there's rabbits, there's coyotes, mm-hmm. there's rattlesnakes, there's tarantulas. And
it's like about $150 an acre now or so.
And no water, no electricity. Yeah. There's mud, heavy, heavy mud, deadly mud in the spring.
Oh, you can't flash floods and stuff, right?
There's flash floods, but not this stuff is high prairie, okay. 7,500 feet. And there isn't flash floods there, but the mud, Jesus, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, I had to walk like a quarter mile from the graveled road where I'd leave my car, and I'd walk through mud to my place. But it was mine, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that you'd see out there, there was a number of these places. They were called Section 11, Section 33, Section 14. So these were sections of land. You'd see a young couple. They're in their early 20s. They got a kid. They got an old beat-up car. And they're building a house out of mud. And it's their house. It's a young couple.
Mm-hmm.
And they're free. They're mm-hmm. independent, you know? And there isn't that many ways to make money out there. A lot of people wouldn't build a conventional home with a foundation and 2x4s right. and stuff like that. You could make adobe walls. There was all these alternative building techniques that are flourishing
mm-hmm.
there now.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can
you got all that mud.
You got all that mud. Yeah, you can build stuff out of mud and it'll last for hundreds of years.
Yeah, adobes are very energy efficient too.
It's great.
It's cool in the summer and right. warm in the winter.
That's right. And you can make that stuff. I should have done that. I should have done that. But I should have made adobe bricks just, you know, 100 a summer.
Mm-hmm.
But I was obsessed with writing my book.
Okay.
And which I would like to, since I'm here in the room and we're talking into microphones.
You could plug it again.
I would like to talk about my book because it's relevant to all this stuff, democracy. So I wanted to mention about seeing those young couples in their car with their baby, their marriage, you know, and there they are with their own property. They were like kings and queens, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were so... They had such a sense of dignity. They didn't have much, but they didn't need much. They had the basics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to. They might be sleeping in a tent while they're building their mud house, but out there, the value system was so different.
Mm-hmm.
You'd look at somebody, and you'd see the shine in their eyes.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've got freedom. They're not a slave for the wage and still be in debt. You know, they're not in debt for $500 a parcel. You know, you've got that paid off in no time.
Yep. Well, yeah, it's more expensive now. Mine was really cheap, but you can still find people. I never mentioned that people would win these things. They'd go out there, see this acre way out there in the sage land, and they'd say, ha, 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 imagine that, we own that. Ha, ha, ha. They'd drive back to Texas or Connecticut or whatever. They'd forget to pay their taxes.
I'll lose it, I see.
And then they'd go up for auction. So the early people would buy 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 quarter acres that were all adjoining for like $35 a piece, because mm-hmm. that's what the back taxes were. My taxes are $5 a year. Because it's remote.
Do you still own it?
I still own it.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I love owning it. I'd attempted to buy land in the Zuni Mountains earlier, and my payments were only $100 a month. It was beautiful land. Full-grown ponderosas, piñon pines, like 4.5 feet thick at the base, 45 feet tall.
This is why there's no hippies in Santa Cruz anymore. They've all moved where you can actually get land here. It's ridiculous.
There is that freedom there. And I tell you, you know, it's a big country. There's Utah, there's New Mexico, there's northern Arizona, there's western Texas, you know, Oklahoma. A lot of states have a lot of empty land that isn't necessarily being used for anything, that with all the new technologies, solar panels, rooftop water collection. My neighbors all had
off
rooftop water
stuff,
collection.
Yeah.
And during a drought that lasted for 3 years, it was a heavy, heavy drought. It was sort of like the apex of the 10-year drought that happened. They had cisterns that would fill up in one rainstorm for a year. They'd have water for a year from one rainstorm, you know? So they didn't have to dig a $5,000 well and have electricity to run it. They would just dig a big hole, line it with cement, and let the water go off their rain spouts into the hole in the ground that had a cover on it. And that, as drinking water, you'd put a, my neighbor, Don, he didn't even put any bleach or any kind of, bactericide in it. His water was fine. But that sort of thing is still possible.
Mm-hmm. It's the back the land sort of revolution. But then you're also cut off from society to a certain extent, so you're quite a ways from the masses of people, right?
Well, you are cut off from society. You are a different society when you're living like that. And that's, I think it's a good thing. You know, something that we're lacking, that we never achieved as an alternative culture. And something that I'm intrigued with myself, having stood at the corner of Haight and Ashbury Streets as a 16-year-old, is that the 60s, the phenomena of the 60s, was the people that went through the psychedelic mental change. We're all still here. The 60s didn't happen in the 60s. The 60s is happening right now. We're still here. Most of the bands are still alive and performing. Not that that's necessarily relevant, but we who were in our teens then, I'm just going to be 60 next year. There's people who are 70 in great health, you know? There's people who are at 80 and in great health, and we're all still here. And I think that we make a kind of a psychic fabric. I think that we are a tribe, all of us. We are a tribe that we came here to incarnate.
At this critical time.
At that time, to be together and to put this change that we have put on the world.
And that Do you think we were part of the same kind of movement wherever we came from? All incarnated together as, this moving body?
I think it is. It makes sense to me because there are psychedelic people. You know one when you're talking to one. You don't have to say much. You don't have to talk about mystical things. You know you're talking to a head when you are.
We're all around the same age, so we all kind of lived through it. What was also big back then, you were talking about revolution, nonviolence, or if you're not willing to die for it, you should armed struggle revolution. I take the third way, which is what was used back then, LSD weapons. I consider them you can use them as a weapon for warfare. I think it would end a lot of the problems we have with war today. If we were using it in the Middle East, they'd all be hippies there. We wouldn't have any problems.
Well, let's get into that. Now, in metaphysics, a basic understanding, a fundamental understanding, is that the physical body is built around an etheric body. That you have an etheric body.
An electric body. There's a multiple bodies in Tibetan.
There's multiple bodies. Yeah. But there's basically three, I think, to keep it simple. There's this body, and then there's the body that precedes it, which is kind of like the DNA description of this body that is in the astral. And then there's a spirit body, and that's like a kind of a formless body. So those are that's to keep it simple. I think it's just that it's those three. And so the rule of metaphysics is that if you create it in the astral, it will become physical. So
that's the Kabbalah uses that too.
Things come down.
Yeah,
they go down.
It comes from God's idea to the angels to the book Yetzirah talks of the book of formation. Talks
it
about
goes
things
down
like
through
that.
The planes. Goes down through the planes into the physical plane.
Becomes physical.
So that in my novel, I wanted to say something all my life. I started typing like a maniac when I was 16 years old. It was like I had an imprint. You're going to write a book. You're here to write a book. That was it for me. I wanted to write a book. I read everything that I could get my hands on. I read most of what Henry Miller wrote by the time I was 20, which was really lucky for me because I needed a father, and he was a pretty good one for me. But I'm a big reader, and I'm endlessly still just drawn to great literature. I just read a great novel by a woman named Leslie Marmon Silko called Ceremony. Which is a really good book. You ever read that?
I did.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I read that book. There's a course that's is taught at Cabrillo College by a professor who teaches all Native American literature. That's really cool. Uh-huh. We reviewed that book.
Well, I just read that, and I was really, really moved because particularly because it all takes place where in places where I lived in New Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
Gallup is near where my land was in the Zuni Mountains. And then I worked, I got a couple certificates in permaculture, and I put permacultural demo sites on Indian reservations. And one was down near Socorro, which is where part of the action takes place. So Socorro and Gallup were the area of the book. So I know what that land looks like. I know what those Indians are like. That was a very moving book, but I thought she was an astoundingly creative writer. She does something in there that is even more gripping than what they call the magical realism. The magical realism of South America that was considered sort of like the newest wave of creative writing. Well, she wrote that book in I think the early 80s. I don't know when he wrote his book, that 100 Years of Solitude is the famous book of magical realism. Mm-hmm. But that book, Ceremony, it's written so that it hooks into your disease, and it takes you into your hunger to transform and to be relit. It does it. It's a powerful, beautiful book. This is what I attempt to do in my book. I was carrying a number of ideas around with me, and I did something, a ceremonial that made me start writing one day in longhand, because by then my solar panels weren't working and I'd burned out three word processors writing. And I wrote in law, I still have it. I wrote for 12 hours. I wrote in longhand the gist of this book that I then worked on for the next 7-8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I took some interesting metaphysical facts that exist. One is that the Army Blue Book Project was a collection of reports on UFOs from about 1945 mm-hmm. until 1967. It was by the Army. They took all this information from
Air Force, I think.
Air Force?
Yeah, I believe it's Air Force.
Okay. So they took all this information as a military study. What is this thing that people are talking mm-hmm. about? Because enough people were reporting things to the cops, to mm-hmm. you know, the military.
I had a copy of that for a while. It's a big, thick thing.
Yeah, I never read it. But I knew about it. That they had thousands of reports from reliable witnesses. They took everything that couldn't be considered reliable on a military basis. And they kept things by airline pilots, cops, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And they still had thousands of reports of people witnessing something. And their conclusion was that since 1945, there had been radar all over the planet, that if there were things that were being witnessed by people that weren't human-made, that because anything coming in from outer space could be tracked to within 100 feet of where it landed by radar, that whatever was being seen was not coming in from outer space, it was coming from parallel dimension.
Mm-hmm. There's probably some of that involved,
This was the military viewpoint. So I took that, and I took another fact. Robert Monroe spontaneously left his body one Sunday afternoon when he took a nap in 1957 or something. He was a very successful businessman. He owned radio stations. He wasn't religious, and he just spontaneously left his body and floated around his house and retained consciousness. And then he was so intrigued by it, he kept leaving his body and experimenting.
Mm-hmm.
And then he started to go crazy because he couldn't talk to anybody about this. Mm-hmm. And he went to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist didn't know what he was talking about, so he was totally on his own, which is mind-boggling to think of the courage to go on with this sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
But he did things to prove to himself that it was real. He would visit his daughter. He would go to places that he would go to in his astral body the next day and identify them as real.
It's similar to remote viewing, right?
It was remote viewing in that way, which is something that to be discussed. It's a good mm-hmm. one. So Monroe talked about one way that he could leave his body by going out his forehead, by going out his chest, by going out, rolling to the side, or he, and whenever he could go in this astral body, he could go into other dimensions. He could leave the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And he could talk with extraterrestrials, extra physicals. Mm-hmm. Incredible stuff. It's just astounding stuff. And it's so believable because he's not trying to... The very first book is a journal. He actually published his journal entries as he had these experiences. And one of the ways that he left his body was that he would turn around inside his physical body and go out the back of his head.
Mm-hmm.
And when he did that, he always went to the same place. It was a world that's just like the human world. There was people, they had jobs, they went to colleges, they had families, they lived in houses, they had buses and cars, but it was all different. But they looked human. Mm-hmm. And he visited this one couple for years, studying them. So I was intrigued with this in light of the fact that in pre-Christian Europe, there was the fairy religion.
Right.
Yeah.
Where the fairies were a huge deal in pre-Christian Europe. And E. Evans Wentz...
I have that book.
E. Evans Wentz translated he made the first translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Mm-hmm. He also... Tibetan Yoga and Secret Doctrine is a very good book. He did as well.
Oh, what was that called?
Tibetan Yoga and Secret Doctrine. It's got several practices and techniques of leaving the body, all kinds of the tumo for psychic heat and stuff. It's one of my favorite books, actually.
That sounds interesting. He wrote his thesis at Oxford became a book that's still published, and it's called The Fairy Cultures in Fairy.
He interviewed
a lot
of people.
The fairy religion in the Celtic cultures of
Western Europe.
Yeah,
I have that book, too. He interviewed a lot of people.
He interviewed people, yeah. In all the Celtic countries of Europe, which was Brittany, Wales, Scotland, Ireland, mm-hmm. Galicia in Spain, and Brittany, which is where... Brittany and in Cornwall, which is where my people come from. So he was describing... the fairy religion, evidently... people talked about... Not only did they see these beings, and did they snatch babies, for instance, mm-hmm. or mutilate cattle, but they also could interbreed with humans.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people who were known as part fairy people. And mm-hmm. In Ireland, this is still a big thing, that some people are considered fae, which is an expression of being... etherically different than other mm-hmm. people.
And they have like second sight or some kind of vision.
Second sight. That's also a fairy thing, a fae thing.
You can see the fairy. There may be some around us right now, although they prefer attractive environments and
right.
the woods maybe, but not here.
Yeah. So there's these things that they're around rational reality of humanity. UFOs, mm-hmm. transdimensionalism, parallel dimensions, and so in my story was like a vision. All these facts that I was holding in my head that I thought this all means something. All this stuff connects somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I came to the conclusion that that because the dinosaurs had lived for 60 million years, that they had created a reincarnational culture.
Mm.
That they were very intelligent beings, and just because they were reptilian and carnivorous and predatory does not mean that they weren't intelligent and that they couldn't have an astral existence. They were reincarnating just like the Tibetan monks were.
Probably,
but instead of lamas, they were ever more adept predators. And during the process of that, I don't know, about 100 million years that the dinosaurs existed, it was 60 million years was how long the Tyrannosaurus rexes existed. And the rexes only lived in America.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
They were nowhere else.
Yeah.
They lived...
I didn't
Tyrannosaurus
know that.
Rexes were only in America. And so they created a reincarnational culture before they died. But then when in my book, there used to be a second moon. And when the second moon crashed to the Earth, it was a smaller moon. And it got sucked into the gravity and it crashed on the Earth and it caused the end of the Jurassic by creating obscuring the sun.
Right, this is your book. Now,
this is my
right?
book. Okay. This is my book. It's not necessarily, you know, scientifically corroborated.
Where was your book again? Online?
What's it called?
Well, where was it online if people wanted to look it up?
It's called Reptile Conspiracy. And, well, it's called Reptile Conspiracy !! Because it's meant as a kind of a humorous call to arms, but a call to magical arms.
Mm-hmm. And that was, where was that on? What's the URL?
It's on www.lulu.com/reptile conspiracy as one word.
Okay.
Yeah.
Slash.
Yeah.
No exclamation in the URL.
No exclamation. Slash right. Reptile Conspiracy. And half the book, 10 chapters, are a free download.
Okay.
Which I want to entice people to read that much so that they'll read the rest of it. So I just want to mention the positive side of this. The Tyrannosaurus Rexes began reincarnating before their culture was annihilated, so that when they were annihilated by the fall of the moon, they simply went into their transdimensional vortex and waited for humans who they knew were coming down the line, because they didn't want to follow through on a contract they had made with collective humanity as souls who designed this solar system and designed this Earth. We designed this solar system and this Earth so that we could live here. And we hired the Tyrannosaurus Rexes to exist in a predatory state for that long in order to grow the reptilian brainstem, which is a real thing upon which the human brain is built. Our brain sits on the reptilian brainstem. And in my story, it required that much predatory violence and competition to create the reptilian brainstem for some reason. Anyway, from the beginning of the very first humans, the reptiles, who were highly intelligent and had the ultimate goal the reason they didn't want to leave was because they were emotionally attached to the blood of their ancestors, which was spilled in the earth. The blood of the Tyrannosaurus Rexes and of all the vegetation in their worldly paradise. And they wanted to manipulate humanity to one day create, through religious indoctrination, educational systems, and just social manipulation, they wanted to create an industrial culture that would one day dig up the blood of their ancestors, petroleum.
You know, this, I've had similar ideas. You know, they talk about the Satan being raised from to be freed on the earth for 1,000 years. I mean, and that oil is it's dead. Like you said, it's dead matter from the dinosaur age or
it's
whatever.
Black.
It's black, you know, and. You know, in magic, there's vortexes and liquid. They use blood for a lot of ceremonies. So it's like old blood.
Old blood.
And so
old
it's just
blood.
Like evil being unleashed on the world that will cause this ecological disaster that will destroy humanity. There's a kind of an evil to it.
I really believe that.
And you look at driving a car. We're accepting the fact that there's over 40,000 people a year in the United States die in car accidents. We're accepting a certain amount of human sacrifice just to drive our car.
Uh-huh.
And then to get the oil, we have to go overseas and kill people.
Uh-huh.
There's more evil. And
more
then
evil.
In the end, we're going to cause this ecological disaster.
And people are sold religion in order to stay in line and believe in the virtue of serving a society that does this sacrifice. This
mm-hmm.
sacrifice is good. It's good in the eyes of the Lord. We're sold this theology, you know.
Mm-hmm. And so then it gets back to the land too. I mean, the Bilderberg. I'm not sure if you heard of the Bilderberg Group. You were talking before about England owning most of the America or the world, 1/6 of the world. They're all the crown princes of Europe, the oil companies and the banks who make money off land, and maybe a few media people or something. But it's that land owning the oil. It's
tradition.
That,
it's the land owning tradition.
Yeah, it's that
they're
evil.
Used to owning entire forests, mountain ranges.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think in terms of owning 600 acres of land, they think in terms of owning Siberia.
Mm-hmm. The people who live on it.
And the people who
the
live
serfs,
on it.
Right,
the animals, the native animals.
Yeah, you can't go surf, you can't hunt in their forest, they own all the animals.
That's right, poaching. It was against the law to poach. To hunt.
It's
on
weird.
Their land.
All this evil kind of ties together, and this goes back to the Bilderbergers didn't just appear in 1954 during the. It was under an eclipse, by the way. The 1954 eclipse is related to Bin Laden and something that's going to happen here as well. They're part of the Venetian black nobility. They go way back, and in Venice, you know, Venice. You have this ocean-going civilization all around the world throughout history with their secret societies. It moves from place to place. It was Minoa back in, you know, 1600 BC, and the Venetians through the Middle Ages, and then you were talking about England. There's always those components of they control the trade. They are ocean-going. In ancient times, it was human sacrifice, megaliths. And astrology, and the secret, you know, the Hierophants would keep that secret knowledge. It's interesting. I mean, all these things pull together. You're hitting all the notes.
That's how I felt. It's like there's all this information, and you think, how does it all tie together? You feel like it does tie together. Like for instance, people are one of the chief forms of lust. That wealth exercises is the desire to own jewels. In doing magic, jewels are assigned to each of the planets. And if you want to make talismans, which are houses for spirits that you create, you invent a spirit and you give it life and purpose through the spark of divinity within you, you have the right to create more life. You not only can create life biologically, you can create life psychically. Mm-hmm. And there are vast formulas for doing this. There's thousands of books about this. In all the years that I looked into New Age type stuff, I never came across the tradition of Western magic. I talked to so many people. I went to all the bookstores. I listened to all the radio shows, everything. I never learned about the tradition, Western tradition of magic. The way that I finally learned about it was that I saw a book being thrown out on a porch in my neighborhood in the Zuni Mountains. Somebody had taken a book and they'd thrown it away with a bunch of other books as a free giveaway, right? Mm-hmm. They put it on their front porch. And one of the books was called Modern Magic by Donald Michael Craig. And it's 11 Lessons in the High Magical Arts is what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the stuff that Moses and Solomon did. These are the basics of original
Western. You still
Western.
Have that book?
You can buy it on the internet.
Oh, okay.
Used.
Okay.
Donald Michael Craig, Modern Magic, Llewellyn Books.
Oh, Llewellyn.
It's sold 100,000 copies. A lot of people have read it. I got into it very, very cautiously.
What's the gist of it?
The gist of it first of all, well, you use sacred geometry, which mm-hmm. is fundamentally pentagrams and hexagrams, which are symbols of integration of energy. Pentagram is the four elements conjoined through the fifth element, ether.
Yeah.
And so it's a magical thing, not only because of that number, and the shape of a star and the, you know, symbology of a star in the heavens, mm-hmm. but because it's the number of the goddess, and it's the reason that it is that is because
Venus.
Most flowers have five petals.
Venus makes a pentagram in its orbit.
Oh, it does.
So it's just well, in some
see,
way.
That's
some
subtle because I've never mm-hmm. seen it. You'd have to really.
I'll show you. I forget what it is. Some part
you
of
you have to be a real student of things, but. Just on the plane level, if you cut an apple open, you'll see a star.
Mm-hmm.
If you,
we're five.
You know,
we're based on five.
We're
you
based
know.
On five. That's yeah. right. Yeah. Well,
the limbs
women are
and the
based
head.
On five. Men are based on six.
Well, the limbs and the head. There's five fingers.
No, it's true.
They were fractally.
What about seven. No.
It's true. It's true. Well, seven is a magical number.
Yeah.
The seventh
yeah,
wave.
You better say that.
That's
yeah.
right. Yeah. Modern magic involves banishing negative energy, banishing spirits and energy, just negative energy. And something that a lot of people, they touch on it in New Age stuff, is that negative energy is something that our bodies and psyches produce. Negative energy, just like we produce feces, it's waste matter. The electrical process of the psychic body produces a kind of waste matter, and if you don't consciously get rid of it, it accumulates and you will attract it.
Yeah. Like plaque.
You will attract darkness if you let darkness in you grow. So that having some way of cleansing, of purifying yourself, is really, really very significant. And also the integration that pentagrams and hexagrams carry. When you create a pentagram or a hexagram and place it inside your body or between your body and something else, other beings know that you're doing this. Our astral bodies are listening and watching. Mm-hmm. One another's astral bodies.
And there's a resonance between thinking about it and the astral. Yeah.
There is, and we perceive on a subtle plane what we're doing energetically, and we're responding to it. And we may not be at all conscious of it, but it'll come out in our dreams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and we'll see the energy interplay differently. So the very first, he's very positive and very cautious and very respectful of these things, which is what attracted me to finish reading the book. You cleanse yourself and you protect yourself. And then it's possible to do three main things which are done in Western magic. One is create talismans during the waxing moon to attract things. And the other is to create amulets during the waning moon to get to... cast off things, banish things. You get rid of things, or you banish energies from you, or you create protection to, repel energy away from you. And the very first talisman that I made,
said there were three. What was it?
The third one is scrying, where you make you take a plate of glass and you paint it black on the back of it, and you place it at an angle in front of an individual who is etheric and can see things intuitively. And then you do the ceremonial magic, and they look at it like a TV, and they tell you what they're seeing. And the less rational they are, the more effective they are. One of the most famous
Delphi Oracle or something
of this was John Dee, who was the king's... He's described in history as Queen Elizabeth's astrologer, but he was a magician.
He's also a spy, I believe.
Oh.
I think I heard he was involved in some of that.
Oh. Well, I think he was the magician, and then his scryer was a guy who was very etheric and could read this stuff. But you know, if the guy didn't... He wasn't just Elizabeth's astrologer. He was her magician.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the royal... people, the aristocrats of all cultures, have employed magicians, because both the magicians knew that they had power and that they could demonstrate it, and the royal people knew from traditions of knowledge, experience, is particularly in warfare for material property.
Mm-hmm.
They
what?
Knew that they could influence the weather.
Even today, you know, they would use remote viewing for spying, you know, recently in the military.
Good point. Yeah. That's a very good point, yeah. Remote viewing is something that... I read a book by a guy who was in the military who was a remote viewer in the employ of the Army. And he described how remote viewers are utilized... he describes how someone in his unit was sent to Beirut to a three-story house where they were holding hostages, so that he could see where in the building they were, where the hostages were, so that if anybody else moving around that could be perceived through a kind of radar that could see through the walls, they could shoot those people through the walls and know that they weren't shooting the hostages. They used remote viewers for this. And he was a remote viewer. And this book was so creepy that I couldn't stand having it on my property, and I eventually threw it away because
okay. I didn't ask if you had it. Now we know.
It was creepy, and I don't even know what the guy's name was. I got so repelled by it.
Oh, this is the remote viewing book.
Remote viewing book. This guy, it was fascinating what he was talking about, but there was something really bad about that energy. One of the things he says, he describes this. He says, so the first time I went to this building in Washington, D.C., where this headquarters were for the remote viewing, I walked in and I saw that all along one wall there were windows, and on the windowsill there were all these dead geranium plants. Oh. And I got that image, all these dead geranium plants, and instantly I thought, this is bad vibes. These people are dealing in anti-life forces, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's military, too. I mean, when you dabble in magic and stuff, and then you're also doing war, I mean, you're working with the dark side.
That's right. Well, this is one of the things that makes Robert Monroe incredibly fascinating, and I encourage people to really look into Robert Monroe. He's very positive, very intelligent writing. There's all killer, no filler in his books. And they're very short and to the point, and he doesn't try to talk into anything. He says, this is what I saw. It's very convincing. One of the things that he mentions in his first book, which is his journal that's published, is that he used to travel around. He'd take a plane to a place, and he'd go like do stuff for promotional stuff for his radio stations. He went to Nantucket in the early 60s, and he checked into a hotel somewhere, and he was tired from the flight, and he lay down and took a nap. He left his body, which would happen to him after a certain point automatically, and he'd be drawn to energy events that were happening near him. Mm-hmm. He was drawn to go to a lawn outside of a house somewhere in Nantucket. Sun was shining, middle of the day. It was the same time of day as he was sleeping in his bed in the hotel. And this man comes walking around the corner of the building holding a .45, and he says to him, "What are you doing here?" Threateningly, pointing the gun at him. Robert Monroe freaked and slammed back into his body and sat up in the hotel room, and he said, "What the hell was that? The guy could see me, and he's pointing a gun at me, and I wasn't physical." He's like, what's going on? And he realized then that Kennedy, who was president at that time, was all over the news. He was going to Nantucket for his vacation. And that was the house where Kennedy was at in his vacation, and he had a psychic guard. He was a head of state who had a psychic guard anticipating visits in the astral.
Wow.
And this was in the early 60s.
You know, I think it was an alien agenda. I was reading the remote viewers were scouting out UFOs and stuff, and the people the Grays didn't really mind, but there was an overseas guy who saw the remote viewer there and turned some knob, and the remote viewer got tingles all over his pain all over his body and got snapped out of there. So it's probably one of those bodies you were talking about, the etheric or the electromagnetic or something that's traveling and can be messed with.
It's energy. It's all energy. Mm-hmm. And there are techniques for doing things with energy. Mm-hmm. We are creators, and we can create things. You can't just create anything. In the Western tradition of magic, you do a divination before you do any kind of a magical construct to check out to see if what you're doing is good or bad. And the example that's used is you may want $50,000 and you may make some powerful magic to get $50,000 and your parents will die in a car crash and you'll get the insurance. Mm. That's the kind of magic you don't want to do. So
exactly.
You do a divination to see if it's it's okay to go along with this. Well, the very first time that I made a talisman, I'd just gotten to the end of the talisman making section, and I thought, okay, I'm into it. I want to try it, right? So when you do a talisman, you have to do it at the planetary hour and on the planetary day. The day for wealth is both Thursday, which is ruled by Jupiter, and Sunday, which is ruled by the Sun. Jupiter being more toward money, the sun being more toward really
power. Jupiter's power.
Friendship and healing, and and less material stuff. But Jupiter is the day for money, and the hour there's two planetary hours during the course of each 24 hours when that hour for doing the workings exists, and this has been accepted for thousands of years that this is true in most Western cultures. Because they all have the same attributes for the days of the week. Moon day, Tuesday, which is Mars, which the names of the days of the week go along with the Norse gods and goddesses. Tyr, for Tuesday, was the god of war. Wednesday was Odin's day, the day of magic, which in the Latin-speaking countries is Miércoles, which is Mercury. Mercury is the day of magic. It's the magician, eighth Sephira. Yeah. It's the magician in the number
magician
eight.
Card is Mercury, yeah.
Yeah, and so Mercury is magic, and which is both male and female. And then Jupiter, Thursday was Thor.
Thor's Mars.
No, Thursday is Jupiter. Thursday was the biggest planet in the solar system is Jupiter. So that's the thunderer. That's the big one.
So Odin's day is Mars then? Which one's Mars?
No, Odin's day is Wednesday. Woden's day.
Magic.
And magic. He was a magician. Woden was considered a magician.
Which one's Mars then?
Tuesday?
Which one's Venus? Oh, Venus is Friday. So what planet
Freya,
is...
Freya
what was planet is Wednesday then?
Mercury? Yeah. Miércoles. Mercury's day.
And Thursday's... Okay. Which one's on Saturday, Sunday. Okay, okay.
So then the hours are for the dawn of each of those days is the planetary hour of those days, and the length of the days changes with the seasons. They're equal on equinoxes; they're all exactly the same, mm-hmm. 1 hour for each sign, twice through the 24 hours. Mm-hmm.
But so you made the talisman. What were you trying to achieve with your talisman?
I wanted to make $4,000. Okay. I needed money, yeah. And so I chose four is the number of Jupiter. It's the fourth Sephira, and so Jupiter. I thought if I made it $4,000, Jupiter would be pleased with that and give it to me, right? Okay. Yeah. So I said, I'm going to make it for $4,000. And I was so unready for this. I didn't have any of the paraphernalia. I didn't have the cup or the wand or the dagger. I didn't have the black boxes, well, the square boxes for the altar.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used my saxophone case and I put a black shirt over it.
It doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter. As long as you got the spirit. You know?
That's the spirit, yeah.
And the procedure is it's a very particular procedure where you do the banishing, then you do the invocation, and then you, once the invocation is made, which is the four elements mm-hmm. being called into action, then you work the magic, which is that you're going to, you've made a physical picture of all the things involved. Like you've got a piece of paper, you want to use what are called correspondences.
Mm-hmm.
The number four.
The resonances.
The number four.
Color.
The word four. The color. Blue.
Mm-hmm.
Blue sapphires are assigned to Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
The blue sapphire.
This is Kabbalistic stuff too.
It's all interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And so you use the word four. Let's see. For Jupiter, I think it's the horn of a unicorn.
good luck there.
Tin is assigned to Jupiter, so you can draw a picture of a tin can.
Okay.
You know, and
since they're all astral, anyways, it's all symbols and visualization.
It's symbols in order to create a mental correspondence with energies,
mm-hmm.
and it's very subtle stuff, and it's very ancient stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'm doing this thing. I'm reading the book by candlelight, you know, and I'm just like having to. And now I draw the picture of a can over the... I took a piece of paper, but I wanted a physical object to do the actual you do the whole deal, and at a certain moment you say, now you're going to you're creating a life force is what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you call this life force out of nothingness, and by your divinity, having done a divination so that you feel that you can assign divinity to this thing with confidence. Mm-hmm. It's something good you're doing. It's not something bad. You can assign your divinity to it, and you're using your spark of divine life to create a tool, an energetic tool to achieve an end.
Mm-hmm.
So, sure, yeah, the first thing I thought of was money. And so I made this talisman. I had a blue stone of some kind. Maybe it was a mm-hmm. piece of a turquoise or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the significant moment, you imagine all these workings, all the drawings that you did in midair. You do this a lot. You draw with a wand.
Mm-hmm.
You draw pictures and symbols and signs out of astral energy. And when it's going really good, you do see fire shooting out of your wand. It's astral fire. You create an altered space.
Mm-hmm.
And then you concentrate all this energy, and you see it coalescing and contracting intensely down into the talisman. And you point your wand at it, and you say, "Now come alive." And if it really went well, you'll see a spark. It could be just a glimmer of a spark, or it could be a big bright one. I've only seen the bright one a couple of times out of dozens and dozens of attempts to make all kinds of mm-hmm. talismans.
So what was the result on this one?
So you're supposed to then sleep with a talisman, carry it on your body all the time. Carry the written picture, the whole deal. So about a month goes by, I'm carrying the thing. I've sort of forgotten about it by mm-hmm. this time. I'm just like thinking, well, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I had a date with a woman. We went to a Chinese restaurant. I saw within 5 minutes we were never going to get along.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just like a politely waiting for each other to finish so I could walk her to her car. Walked her to her car. It was dusk. I was, as I'm walking toward my van, I'm walking in the dusk. I'm disappointed that this turned out that way, and I just want to go home. And I'm walking along, and I see a white envelope, a long white envelope, like a letter envelope. On the street, and without thinking, I lean down and I pick it up, and I get in the van, I put it on the dashboard, I start the van, I drive home. On the way home, I think, what the hell did I pick up? You know, and I take the envelope and I feel it. It feels empty. It's just an envelope. Then I feel a lump. Oh wow, I wonder what that is. You know, so I get home, I take it into my place, I light a candle, and I take it out, and it's a 4.25-carat sapphire.
Ooh.
Worth
$4,000.
$4,000.
That's a blue stone, too.
That's a blue stone. That was the first time. The first time that's what happened.
And did you sell it?
I sold it for $400. And I regret it to this day. It would have cost me $350 to have it scientifically authenticated as a sapphire in order to market it. Right?
Right.
That's what they charged. And so I went to a jeweler, and he said, "Oh, I'm not sure if this is a real sapphire or not. It might just be glass, cut glass. Probably is. So I'm taking a chance here. I'll give you $200 for it." I said, "Nah, at least $500." He says, "Well, $400 is the highest I'll go." I said, "Oh, okay." I was desperate. I mean, I was eating, you know, macaroni and cheese, you know, and tea without sugar, and it was winter, and I was cold, and I was desperate for money, so I gave it up. But boy, did I regret it. But there was.
Did you find that ironic that you got this gift, but you know you didn't have much control over? It just was there, but you didn't really get.
The
what
full
I mean
4,000.
Is, you have to. You don't ask for a specific thing. Because
I asked for money. I asked for $4,000. I wanted money. But yes, it came out that way. It
right,
came to me.
Because you get what you're supposed to get or what you need. Or something.
Right, right. You got what you asked for, but in a different form.
Right,
in a different form. And so that is an aspect of the workings. Now, to get off that material angle, I mean, you know, you need money, you need food. Mm-hmm. Food is health, you know. Money is health to me. Mm-hmm. Well, I did a lot of other things with talismans. Another one that I did, for instance, that was extremely useful to me. I had a love affair where I was very in love with this woman, and circumstances caused us to get broken off in such a way that I could never see her again, call her on the phone, or visit her. Just, it's a whole story, but I was completely X'd out of her world. She later on tried to find me, but at that moment, I was X'd out of her world. I was just heartbroken and frying in heart loss. And I wanted to resolve this thing with her, and I couldn't talk to her, so I made a talisman to encounter her in dreams. And I had 14 dreams in which I talked to her in these different ways about different things and resolved my condition. So you can do all kinds of things with it. You can do it for health, you can do it for... I did a lot for astral travel, some for protection from enemies, from bad energy, mm-hmm. and for inspiration, stuff like this.
Do you still do this? When was the last time you did it?
I don't want to talk about that.
Okay.
But, so where this relates to democracy, egalitarianism in my novel is that in my novel, which was a... It was a vision. It was a vision that was coalesced into a story. And it drew on these elements that I mentioned about a parallel world and people, the fairies, mm-hmm. Living in a parallel world, and the Tyrannosaurus Rexes being the an alien spirit force that entered our realm through the reptilian brainstem that mm-hmm. they created in order to manipulate us to dig up the oil.
Mm-hmm.
And the process by which they did this was orthodox religions and monarchies. That those beings, who are very powerful, non-human entities, entered into lineages of priestcraft and of royalty. And they cultivated those same families, mm-hmm. and they were reborn within those families.
That's kind of David Icke stuff, too, right? The British royal family is a bunch of draconians.
Yeah, because those people were bloodlines of power. And the thing that they concentrated on most, and this is, I think, the point of all of this, is that they repressed our confidence to be imaginative creators. Mm-hmm. We are imaginative creators. And these techniques of magic and the traditions that exist for utilizing creative power in order to achieve an end are available to us. Though we don't have military power, we can't use guns, we're nonviolent people, we're a love people, there is magic. And magic mm-hmm. is a powerful force, and it does work.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know, prayer is actually a form of magic as well.
It is a form of magic. It is a form of magic. So magic is just a word. It's an old word for energy manipulation.
Yeah, you're imposing your will on the creation or whatever.
You're aligning your will with creation and promoting the better aspects of it in material conditions that evidently divinity can't see, and that we are the eyes of divinity.
We're voting.
Details.
It's like magic or a prayer. We're voting for a certain outcome.
Yes.
Spiritually.
Yes, we are. And we've been taught to pray. We've been taught to pray in such a manner that we utilize the techniques or the framework of faiths and imagery of divinities and stuff. Whereas the Western tradition of magic is using direct encounter with oneself as divinity, applying a specific creative end to creative energy. And I think that this is the key to what lies ahead of us, is that we have become imprinted with the idea that being manipulated, speaking within the context of the traditions of power, of monarchies, of bloodlines, of religions, is the cap of our imaginations. We're not used to using our imaginations. We have synaptical pathways that have been preset. We've inherited them from our parents, and they from theirs.
It's been grooved.
And our duty is to dissolve these presets and to reclaim a fluid, imaginative confidence as creators, as cosmic egalitarian members of the cosmic democracy, and to reclaim our spiritual identity as empowered beings who can determine the outcome of events and prevent others who are obviously evidentially doing negative things, short-sighted things, destructive things.
This is kind of similar to anarchism as well. I mean, they believe in direct democracy, and that brings up creativity. Like Athens had a lot of creativity because they used direct democracy. And they're opposed to hierarchies. Because when you have a hierarchy, you're kind of, it's all by who's ever at the top. It's their ideas that rule everything below. And anarchism's kind of revolt against them.
I don't like the word anarchy.
Yeah, I know, they've got a bad word.
I don't like the idea of endless freedom. It's like it becomes pointless after a certain point. And there's people who talk about freedom as though they want to be free of their of the whole package. I mean, it's like death. We're in a structure. We have responsibilities within this structure. Mm-hmm. You have a responsibility to your body to go to sleep tonight. You have a responsibility to feed it good food. You likewise have a responsibility to think clear, positive, or equilibrated thoughts. You can't just go thinking about any trashy goddamn thing and filling yourself up with garbage for entertainment purposes or diversions and don't think that there's consequences. We have responsibilities to the divine spark of life within us and to biology itself as a sacred energy. So I think that we as a tribe, as the psychedelic tribe who came in to stimulate, provoke, and inspire a new level of creative thought, our challenge now is to utilize the imagination that the psychedelic inspiration has given us and prevent those who want to keep the oil economy and the oil identity and the hierarchical system. They've got the whole goddamn thing built. They got the refineries, they got the cars, they got the roads. They want to utilize oil to make a brick and mortar world of which they profit, and they hold the manipulative strings. And we want to bring in the solar economy and to utilize appropriate technology and appropriate amount of ownership of tools, of land, of housing. You don't need a whole goddamn 12-story or 12-room house. You only need a little bed to sleep in and a little kitchen to cook in. And if that'll give you a moral lifestyle, it's much preferable than having some big-ass comfortable house to sit there on the couch and watch a big screen TV of people lying to you, you know? So, the spirit of democracy is something, I think, that needs to be spoken about in hallowed tones. Yeah. It is a holy thing. It's not just a system of organizing an economy. It's a circuit between our cosmic souls and the destiny of the planetary body, the collective human body. We are part of the collective human body. We are all evolving into a higher realm, and we have a responsibility to limit those people that are promoting negativity and that are abusing magical creative power to reinforce negative ends. We have a duty to limit them, and we have a capacity to limit them because we, by living within cosmic law, we can invoke that cosmic law for our own personal protection, and in doing that, we can exemplify to others that they can do it too. And then we can create a stepping stone into a higher human existence that is more, you know, compatible with what's about to happen, which is that we're about to drop dead. We're all going to die. We are all concerned with the next step after death, and it's a big, big deal. It's more important what you what you're preparing for your death journey than it is to have, you know, a really good car or or a really cool shirt or something.
Well, that's all temporary, and it's, death is permanent.
That's right, and we're going to die. And democracy is something that, you know, it has been started. It's alive, and we need to take it to the next step and the next level. And so, and this doesn't, you know, of course, like diminish our responsibility to vote, to be informed, to inform others, to encourage people who want to run for government. That's not invalid, but that's the physical exercise of astral creative information, is to promote candidates and to encourage people to say, you know, invest money in a race for a mayor or a governor or the creation of laws that, you know, promote a solar economy and transition away from an oil economy. That's a physical reality. But on the other side of it, traditional religions that we've rebelled against and we have freed ourselves from, we can't just stop there. It's not like we're like sort of teenage rebels and we've said fuck you to the powers that be. Now what? You don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? You throw out the bathwater and you still got the baby. That's energy. We are energetic beings in an energetic realm, and we want to create the constructs that will allow for this creative force field to become collective and to give it direction. To which end, for instance, I think that something that's possible with the internet is that a website could be created in which we would envision, you know, kind of like Ecotopia. We could play it as a collective global game that would be available to everybody to play out Ecotopia down to minute details. It could be, you know, you could log in, you would pick an identity as a character. They would have a face. You could draw their face. You could composite their face. You could give them a voice. You'd give them a task. You'd give them a place to live. And you would live a virtual life in the virtual website of Ecotopia. So that we, by creating a construct, an astral construct, to catch the physical structure that's disintegrating around us, the governmental, business, social, psychological disintegration that is happening all around us. If we created an alternative view as a website game, we would create thought channels and ideas for a more creative order to replace that deconstruction with anticipating, you know, social catastrophe and chaos, which is on its way. Mm-hmm. The economy is dying.
Mm-hmm.
The oil economy has exhausted the earth. People's bodies are poisoned, and their minds are poisoned, and there's no envisioned structure to take its place. So that young people say, heroin? You betcha. You know, crack? Yeah, let me have some. Because they don't see any kind of a structure that they could work for. And that's something that we should create.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea. Well, on that note, we should probably wrap it up. It's getting a little late here. And
Well, could go on all.
We'll have to have it back sometime. It's this. I love this kind of stuff. You know,
cool. I love it too. I'm
politics
I'm
and
grateful
religion.
To be here.
Yeah,
I'm grateful to be here.
We'll go over the first half hour there of the free land. We kind of didn't really record.
Could I do one last song?
Sir,
could I do one?
Absolutely.
Last song?
We go on.
Okay. This will be the going out song. Thank you. Justin, going into this song, I want to mention one last part of the novel, Reptile Conspiracy, which is at www.lulu.com/reptileconspiracy is one word, which is a free download. That the culmination of the book, after mentioning all these this battle between really the solar economy and the oil economy, that there's a lot of the action takes place in the astral, not the physical. People are leaving their bodies and having encounters in the astral, and they're fighting in the astral. And in the astral, it's fair to kill somebody. You can deconstruct them because if they're challenging a cosmic being who has a creative purpose that's connected to the creative intelligence of love, is what I call the divinity, the creative intelligence of love. What is not helping this or hindering it has less power than what is helping it and is not hindering it. And this process, the process for fighting in the astral or simply in the imagination, is described in the book. It's called the Ixtelar, and this is the yoga of the imagination. And it has its own language. And in the book, there's a glossary of terms, and the techniques are described. And this is the purpose of the book, is to describe the danger we're in, and to describe the techniques by which to deconstruct it. And one last thing. This radio station probably gets monitored automatically. And it just gets taped on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Maybe by the FBI or something?
Yeah.
Sure.
Or something.
There's probably a bug in here.
They can get it off the internet.
True.
Yeah. They can get it off.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would just like to say that the people who listen to this stuff to monitor it, these aren't, these are like intelligence operatives who are in the service of whatever version of governmental power they understand. They are employed by it, and they serve it to the best of their knowledge and ability. But they're not included in the great rewards of doing evil. As the really top-notch people do. I mean, they don't go to Dick Cheney's parties, you know. They don't get to go to the really hot and heavy stuff. These are men and women who are themselves have aspirations toward democracy, fairness, health, well-being, as they see it. And while they might monitor this sort of thing, they themselves, citizens of the world, citizens of the universe, what we are advancing, promoting, protecting, is in their interest as much as it is in ours. We're not enemies of life or of love. We're enemies, if you would call it that, of out of control materialism. It's unfair that we're born into a world where you have to have a decent enough car to park in a parking lot as you walk across the parking lot to your job to look respectable. Mm-hmm. It's got to be a certain glossy, fairly new car. You got to have certain kind of clothes. Mm-hmm. You can't have cheap shoes.
Come from the right college.
Well, that too. Come from a named college. All mm-hmm. that stuff. It's like that. That isn't necessarily what a person is. That's just the dressing,
mm-hmm.
and
the shell,
and the thing that ultimately each individual soul wants, whether they're a NSA operative or they're a Santa Cruz or a Berkeley or a Madison or a Greenwich Village rebel for democracy is that we're protecting the heart of love and the desire to be free to love in the way that we understand as individuals. And with that, I'd like to wrap that up with this song. Gets hazy, the lines got drawn, and things got crazy. I had to clear my mind and get back my direction. The peace you find, well, it needs some protection. We take sides to stay out of the shadows. You just can't hide your light, and sometimes it can cut somebody. Time out of time, I look back and remember, there was no crime, and I still love you, baby. And it's other faces, all these broken interactions. But how can we start again? Everyone stays inside their borders. When we were 16, we said we'd never hide it. But now it's all going that way. But I still love you, baby. I still love you, baby. Someone will play the upper hand and leave rose petals by the highway, blowing in the wind. But I still love you, baby.
Talking with Clint Barrett, a.k.a. Raven and the Morning Star. Got into magic and some politics. First half of this is available under the Tangerine Dream Team. Hmm. This has been Free the Land, and there's about 20 minutes to a half hour that it's just you're going to have to access the astral plane to hear. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah. What a magical evening.